This sutta starts, the Buddha has, as is usual, gone to this village, and the people in the village say this to him: Lord, we are lay people who enjoy sensual pleasures, dwelling at home in a house crowded with children, enjoying sandalwood, wearing garlands, scents and unguents, accepting gold and silver. Let the Blessed One teach the Dhamma to us in a way that will lead to our welfare and happiness, both in the present life and in the future life as well. So there's these people who are saying basically, you know, we're not monastics. I mean, most of the teachings of the Buddha, we think of them as being focused on monastics. And here's these householders saying, no, what about us? What about us? And the Buddha had a lot of householder disciples. And so this sutta sort of goes through, this is in the section of eights. So there's eight things the Buddha has to say. And he starts out with the first four. There are four things that lead to the welfare and happiness of a family man in this very life. What four? The accomplishment of persistent effort, the accomplishment of protection, good friendship, and balanced living. So this is like not a list you would normally see talking to monastics. It's a different flavor of teaching, and that's why this particular sutta interested me. So let's look at these four, and then we'll talk about how we get to the other four as well here. And I'll read other suttas and other from other places that relate to this. So the Buddha goes on. What is the accomplishment of persistent effort? Here, whatever may be the means by which a family earns his living, whether by farming, trade, cattle raising, archery, or civil service, or by some other craft, she is skillful and diligent. She investigates the appropriate means and is able to act and arrange everything properly. This is called the accomplishment of persistent effort. So, I mean, here the Buddha is saying, make sure you do a good job. I mean, it's hard to, you know, it's like, how does, you know, this is our daily life. Our daily life, we all have ways we sort of live in the world and, you know, do things. Make sure you do a good job. It's like, oh, that's an interesting way to think of practice. But this is practice. This is just as much practice as anything else. You know, he says, I mean, he's quite precise. He says, you know, be skillful and diligent. So do a good job and work hard. And act and arrange everything properly. So do things the right way. Like don't mess around with the other people when you do your job the way it's supposed to be done. There is an interesting other little bit of sutta. This is another piece in the Anguttara Nikaya. And I've seen this before, but never actually in the original form. This is when the Buddha is talking about right livelihood. You know, there we are, the fourth and fifth steps in the Eightfold Path. You know, he's talking about right livelihood as one of those. This is like how we live in the world. Here's a list of, and this is the list called wrong livelihood. These five trades should not be taken up by a lay follower. Trading with weapons, trading in living beings, trading in meat, trading in intoxicants, and trading in poison. These are all, what he's pointing to is don't do things that are harmful. Don't do things that harm other beings. And this list, if you look at the weapons, trading in living beings, slavery, in other words, trading in meat, trading in intoxicants, or trading in poison, these are all things that are harmful to other beings. And so that's a choice we have to make as well. It's like we have to go, I guess I should be careful not to harm others in whatever work I'm doing. Leads me to a little personal story / confession, I suppose. At one time back in my computer dweeb days, I was working on a product that was for automated mapping systems. This is way before Google Maps and all those sort of things. This is like actually making maps that you printed on these huge flatbed plotters. It was like actually drawing maps with software. And I was writing and building the software. And we were actually doing a whole special version of this for the Australian Navy. And it was just fascinating because it had to do with, you know, charting depths and waters and coastlines and all these rocks. And it was just a different sort of thing. So it was interesting. And then I went down to Australia to actually install this software. And, you know, it never occurred to me, why is the Australian Navy so interested in drawing? You know, it's like, well, they were on the water, so they were charting the coastline, I guess. And I said, why is this such a big deal? Why did the Navy take this on? I asked one of the Navy guys there, and said, oh, you know, we have so much coastline, we don't know it very well, and we need to have really good maps of the coastline so we can find Russian submarines. This is back in the Cold War days. And it was like, oh, finding Russian submarines. And this is like, and I actually went back and 6 weeks later, I quit that job. I was like, oh, I can't do this. I can't be involved. It was like, just, it didn't feel right. It was fascinating work technically. I loved doing it, but I went, I can't do this. I actually walked away from this really interesting job, because I just couldn't do it anymore. And that's what we have to do. We have to look and see what our work does. You know, in that list I read, well, that's like back 2,500 years ago. I suppose we could look at what we do today and we'd probably find other harmful ways. Me, a spin doctor for a politician would be one that comes to my mind. But, you know, there's lots of ways we could look at our work and go, gee, is this actually wholesome or harmful? And start thinking in those terms when we live in the world and make our living. And the Buddha goes on. So the next piece here was called protection. And what is the accomplishment of protection? A family man sets up protection and guards over the wealth acquired by energetic striving, amassed by the strength of his arm, earned by the sweat of her brow. Righteous wealth, righteously gained, thinking, how can I prevent kings and bandits from taking this away, fire from burning it, floods from sweeping it off, and unloved heirs from taking it? In other words, he's saying, you've got to not only, you know, it's okay to make money, you better take care of it. Make sure, you know, once again, this would be a different list these days. This is like in the culture of rural India 2,500 years ago, which was a very agrarian culture. These are the things that people had to worry about, how they would have cattle and someone come and steal their cattle, that sort of thing. So it's another interesting thing to think about. You know, today we have to think about watching for internet scams. Just as a thing that immediately came to mind. I mean, I must get 2 internet scam emails a day in my junk mailbox. It's incredible how, but they must work because people keep sending them out and people, I suppose, keep falling for it. Anyway. Then the third thing on the list is, here's the third thing. And what is good friendship? Here, in whatever village or town a family man dwells, she associates with householders or their sons and daughters, whether young or old, who are of mature virtue, accomplished in faith, virtue, generosity, and wisdom. She encourages converses with them and engages in discussions with them. He emulates them in regard to their accomplishments in faith, virtue, generosity, and wisdom. This is called good friendship. So this is, he's talking about here the importance of Sangha. This is like a central theme all through the Buddhist teachings. It's so important that we have others we associate with who are of like mind, and that because hanging out with these people encourages us to practice. Because we see the effect of their practice on their life and how they're living a life of virtue, etc. And we go, oh, this is nice. Just to be with these people, be with these people and hang out with them feels right. And it encourages us to sort of lead a similar life. There is in the Samyutta Nikaya, a very famous teaching. I'm sure some of you have heard me read at least 50 times before, but an interesting, here this is in the monastic world, but it's the same idea. So this is Ananda, who's the Buddha's cousin, and he's also his attendant for the last 25 years of his life. Ananda talking to the Buddha. So Ananda says, "Venerable sir, this is half of the holy life. That is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship." "Not so, Ananda. Not so, Ananda." This is the Buddha replying. "This is the entire holy life, Ananda. That is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. When a bhikkhu has a good friend, a good companion, a good comrade, it is expected that he will develop and cultivate the noble eightfold path." Sangha is everything. It's so hard to do what we're all trying to do in our own ways. This intention we form to practice and study the Buddhist teachings and practice them. It's really hard to do it on your own. And that's why Sangha is so important, because just like he described in this other sutta, it's like it encourages us. It's like we see other people practicing, and it's such a powerful energy. That's why we get together like this on a Thursday night, when we all could be doing something else, right? And here we are, we're in Sangha, and we're hearing the Buddha's teachings, and we're practicing together, and it's elevating, it encourages us. And that's what keeps the practice going. It's what keeps us going. If you do it by yourself, yes, the Buddha did do it by himself eventually, after practicing for many years with other people. But that's a very exceptional being who does this by themselves. Most of us need company along the way to keep us practicing and to encourage us to practice. And also, sometimes we're not the encouraged, we're the encourager. Sometimes, we're in one of those spaces like, oh God, I don't know about that, going to that Thursday night group. I could watch a hockey game instead, which is my thing. Right? Then you go to that group and you see these people and you know their faces and you know them and you know them from other contexts, perhaps, like you've sat with them on retreats and those sorts of things. And it's like, oh yeah, this feels better than watching hockey any day. And that's just how it is. We connect in that way. So that's the importance of Sangha. And it's equally important for householders and monastics. It's the same essential idea, just expressed in slightly different words, that's all. But it's actually exactly the same thing. So then the Buddha goes on. And here's the fourth of these things he was talking about. And this is balanced living. "A family man knows his income and expenditures and leads a balanced life, neither extravagant nor miserly, so that his income exceeds his expenditures rather than the reverse." Fine. Isn't this? This sounds like, good, plain old economic advice, doesn't it? But this is like This is the Buddha talking to householders, like live within your means. And this isn't the only place. There's another place I'm going to read in a second where the Buddha talks about this, where he talks about just living a life of moderation. At the same time, not being afraid to spend your money. Don't be miserly. Don't hoard your wealth. You know, let it go out there into the world and be useful. In another sutta, this is the Buddha, and this is a famous sutta called the Four Kinds of Happiness. And here he's actually talking to Ananda Pindaka, who is a famous banker. Okay, so this is a rich guy who was always taking care of the Sangha during the rainy season. He would feed 500 bhikkhus every day all through the rainy season, the 3-month rains retreat. So he's very involved in the Buddha. And he came to the Buddha and said, well, what about us householders? What can we do? What gives householders happiness? And basically the Buddha says, you know, the happiness of possession, which is basically, you know, just as it said here, you know, making money in a just way and accumulating wealth and having it and being able to use it. It's essentially the same words. And then he goes on, he says, then there's the happiness of enjoyment. Here, with the wealth acquired by energetic striving, amassed by the strength of his arms, a family man enjoys his wealth and does meritorious deeds. When he thinks, with the wealth acquired by energetic striving, righteously gained, I enjoy the happiness of having wealth. So the Buddha is never saying to householders, oh, you know, don't be one of those bad wealthy people. You know, which this quote spiritual culture that I come from in the old hippie days, and today you'll find the same thing. There's something about wealthy people are bad. Now it's like wealthy people should enjoy their wealth, their whatever they've earned. But at the same time, and this is what he stresses, this is this, and does meritorious deeds. So this is part of not hoarding. It's like, you know, supporting the Sangha in the Buddha's day. That was very important. But think of all those things we could do with that money that we have instead of hoarding it, sharing it with those fortunate. And also, I think in our culture today, this is equally, you don't even have to talk about money. Because what's more valuable than money sometimes is our time. We're all so busy all the time. And if we can share our time, actually go out into the world and do something just because it needs doing. You know, I was never a big fan of George W. Bush, but he did talk persistently about the 1,000 points of light, this idea of volunteering and helping out in the world, which is how I grew up in the culture I grew up in. And it's such a wonderful thing to do. It's like, it's a way of giving without expecting to get paid for it, without expecting anything, no reward, no acknowledgement of how wonderful you are for doing this, just do it. This is a really powerful thing, way to practice. Then the Buddha goes on. And what householder is the happiness of debtlessness? Here a family man who is not indebted to anyone through any degree, whether small or great, when she thinks, I am not indebted to anyone to any degree, she experiences happiness and joy. Not having debt. What a shocking thing to say in our culture. Which, you know, I must get an offer of a free credit card because I have such good credit rating, blah, 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 blah. You know, one of the letters you get, right? At least once a month, probably twice a month, I get offers of, here's a way you can have more money. Here's a way you can go into debt really easily if you want to. And it's like, it's an insidious thing in our culture. that basically tells us that debt is good. That it's a good idea to be in debt. I've been out of debt now for over 30 years since I paid off my original mortgage. It's the most freeing decision I ever made. Because once you don't have debt, then you don't have to start. I could look at that job I was doing, you know, building maps for people to find Russian submarines hidden in their waters. And I could go, no, I don't have to do this. I can walk away. But if I had a mortgage and the car payments and this, that, and that, I couldn't have done that. It gives you the freedom to direct your life, and it also gives you the freedom to go, I think I'll take a couple of weeks off and go sit a retreat and not have to worry about the financial implications of, well, not working for 2 weeks. It's just that is I keep coming back to this because I think it's so important in our culture. And that at the same time, I also understand, you know, to do certain things in our culture these days. I mean, you can't buy a house space without going into debt. I mean, unless you're like a multimillionaire, right? You can't just go, oh, I think I'll buy a house today. You know? So now it's like, okay, now I'm actually choosing to be in debt. So now what I have to do is choose to be in debt, but do whatever I can to eliminate that debt as quickly as I can. Get out of debt, which means I forego other things. Everybody else is going to Mexico for a vacation, and I go to some nice little town in Colorado for vacation instead. Yeah, I don't have to spend all that money to do other things. And it's just like, if you change your attitude towards how you live your life, so that, yes, I've acquired debt. Yes, it's wonderful to own a house. Speaking from someone who's owned a house one way or another for over 40 years now. It gives you freedom to do amazing things like, you know, have people come to your house and I can teach day longs in my house because I have a big enough space on my back porch. I can have people come. Now, I couldn't do that if I didn't own my house. So it gives you certain freedoms that just don't exist otherwise. But we have to balance that out with other things. I'll say no more. I'm getting on one of my hobby horses, so I have to be careful not to rant too long. So then the Buddha goes on. And this is the it's also talking about not spending more than you earn and not being in debt. This is the advice to householders. What happens when we spend more than we earn? Then we have to worry about the debt. We have to worry about it all the time. And that worry makes it more difficult for us to stay focused and concentrated in practice. It's a pretty straight line equation. So it's like, that's fine. Then the Buddha goes on and says, but now there's these four other things. This is in the section on the eight. So the four other things he's talking about. These four things lead a family man's welfare and happiness in the present life. What are these four? Accomplishment in faith, in virtue, in generosity, and wisdom. Now, I should mention right before this is this whole section I'm sort of skipping over, where the Buddha is saying, and here's things you shouldn't do with this wealth, right? And he's talking about not being, you know, not dissipating your wealth unwisely. Gambling, evil friendship, drunkenness, womanizing. A bit careful with that term, but it's like not going out there and just wasting your money on frivolous things that aren't necessary and tend to be unwholesome. I shouldn't leave that out, even though it's because it's in the sutta. But it's like, think of it, that's sort of, once again, sort of on the level of practical day-to-day life advice. But then here's these four things that lead to a man's welfare and happiness in the future life. And first of all, I want to talk a little bit about future life. In the culture, in Buddhist culture, both in this day and now, if you go to Theravadan Buddhist culture, countries like Thailand and Burma, householders are basically told, oh, don't worry about this meditation stuff. You know, you're too busy, you know, taking care of the chickens and the kids and stuff. So what you want to do is you want to create merit so that your next life, you can be born in a place where you can become a monastic and do some more serious practice. So it's like this accumulating merit for a future life is really emphasized. And that's sort of where the Buddha is coming from here in this sutta. But in this life, I think this is also quite true in our life, in our world we live in, where the idea of accumulating merit is kind of makes me a little uncomfortable, to be honest with you, that idea. But it's, if you think of it this way instead, you know, the four things he's talking about, think of them all as, if I try and live that way, later in life, my life is going to be better. Just this life. Forget about future lives and all that sort of stuff. Just if I live, you know, a life, and you know, here that list is the life of accomplishment in faith, virtue, generosity, and wisdom. If those are the things that are the focus of how I live in the world, then later in this life, my life is going to be much better. Just think of it that way instead. And forget about the cultural implications of it. Just like, it seems so obvious, but it's like, oh, this actually makes sense. Right now, today, if I lead a life of virtue today, I'm not going to have to worry tomorrow about someone finding out about all those horrible things I did, and then I can't get elected as, you know, be a president or whatever. Not that I plan to run for president or any other public office for that matter. But that's, you know. So how is a man accomplished in faith? And this is something I've talked about before, and I sort of hold dear to my heart, actually. Problem with the word faith is some people hear the word faith and it's like, it has that sort of vibe of, you know, believe this or you're going to go to hell sort of faith. And that's not what the Buddha is talking about here at all. He's not talking about faith in that wagging finger way at all. What he's talking about is having faith that the Buddha actually taught. That's what it means today. I mean, the Buddha lived 2,500 years ago. So I can't have, it's pretty hard for me to have faith in the person, the Buddha, the person. But I can have faith that what he taught makes sense. And that one of the things he said is everyone, without exception, has the ability to be enlightened. This is like our birthright. It's our natural birthright. And that's what I have faith in. Not any sort of magical thinking sort of faith. Just faith in the fact that, yeah, this teaching makes sense and it works. And I believe when the Buddha said that this is possible for anyone without exception. That's what I have faith in. And that's my way of thinking of faith in the Buddha, which is also, by the way, when I chant the refuges and I take refuge in the Buddha, that's what I'm taking refuge in. I'm taking refuge in the fact that not only did the Buddha exist and that he taught and his teachings are mind-blowing to me still, but that he said, this is for everyone. Everyone has the ability, everyone is innately capable of being enlightened without exception. That gives me faith. I use the word faith here in the sense of, I can't know for sure that's true because I can't meet the Buddha and I can't talk to him. But it just feels right at the level of my heart. It feels right. So faith. Then there's leading a life of virtue. Well, we could talk about this all day. But basically, you know, in traditional Buddhist teaching, this has to do with the five precepts. You know, non-harming, taking only what is offered, not abusing sexuality, not abusing intoxicants and drugs that cloud the mind and lead to heedlessness. Just looking at your life and going, every time you make a decision, look at it, is this virtuous? Is this leading me towards a mind that's going to be calmer and stiller? Or is this leading me towards a heart mind that's going to be confused and agitated? That's what virtue is about. I mean, virtue isn't like, well, you better be good. Like, virtue is about, if you lead a life of virtue, then your life can actually experience what the Buddha called the bliss of blamelessness. You never have to worry about people going, oh, yeah, but, you know, I saw you, blah, 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 you know, ripping off that, taking those flowers from that flower stand or whatever, you know. That's one I saw once and it really freaked me out watching this guy do that. It's like, it's so simple to lead a life of virtue if you choose to. But it means that leading a life of virtue is a practice. It's something we have to practice all the time. Because every time we make a decision, we have to use that, look at that decision from that particular lens. Is this virtuous? And then let that be the deciding factor. Not is it I want to do it, not is it, you know, someone else told me this is a cool thing to do. None of that. It's like, is this virtuous? If I can see that it's virtuous, then I know it's okay to act or speak in a certain way. And it leads to a happier life, now and later. Then it goes on. And how is a family man accomplished in generosity? A family man dwells at home with a mind devoid of the stain of stinginess, freely generous, open-handed, delighting in relinquishment, one devoted to charity, delighted in giving and sharing. In this way, a family man is accomplished in generosity. The other part of this that I think is really important is that we do all this without expecting anything. Being generous in our culture often means, you know, I gave, I reached the platinum level of giving for such and such a charity. That means my name gets printed in their booklet, or I get a plaque on the wall at the synagogue, or whatever it is, you know. It's like, it's so easy to turn it into a reward. I'm generous because I get this reward. And we don't want to go there. We just need to be able to be generous. Just look for opportunities to be generous. I once heard Joseph Goldstein say, Dharma talk on one of the retreats I was on with him. He said, he was talking with generosity, and he said, whenever the impulse to generosity arises in my mind, I immediately just do it. What an interesting way to live, huh? You have a generous impulse and you just act on it. Right then, just do it. As opposed to what we all do, once again, that was a good idea, but, you know, what about this and what about that? Well, we find the excuses not to do it because I sort of like that thing and don't really want to get wrong. You know, we get caught in that whirling mind of yes, no, maybe. Instead of just, we have this thought of generosity. It's a virtuous, wholesome thought. Act on it. Just do it. Right there. Don't hesitate. It's a different way of living in terms of generosity. And then, he comes to the last list. This is to be accomplished in wisdom. What the heck does that mean? I was wondering. Here, a family woman possesses the wisdom that sees into the arising and passing away of phenomena, which is noble and penetrative and leads to the complete destruction of suffering. In this way, a family man is accomplished in wisdom. So here, the Buddha is talking about right understanding. So now he's not... This is like, you think, oh, wait, this is like what we teach monastics. But no, he's saying, as a householder, this is really important, that we actually have an understanding of impermanence, which is what he was just describing, that everything arises and passes away. It arises, it's there for a while, it passes away. Because without that understanding, we start to get stuck in believing things are permanent, and then because we think they're permanent, we try and hold on to them too tightly. And so, and the other thing about impermanence, the other thing about this idea of right understanding, the understanding of impermanence, which is the beginning of all right understanding, and leads us to form the intention to practice, is that understanding impermanence, and by understanding I mean more than intellectually, though it has to start with an intellectual understanding, but it's like an experiential sense of it, leads directly to the understandings of unsatisfactoriness and not self. It's the one we have to, that has to come first. We have to really understand impermanence, and then once we understand impermanence, unsatisfied, well, see, if everything's changing and nothing's going to last, then everything's unsatisfactory by its very nature. By its very nature, it's unsatisfactory. Everything. This is when people, the Buddhist, you see, he talked with the Buddha saying, everything is suffering. Well, no, everything isn't suffering. It's too harsh a word. But everything's unsatisfactory because nothing lasts. Nothing. Everything is impermanent. And when we understand impermanence, which is what he's saying is the first thing a householder has to do to have wisdom, it naturally just leads to understanding of unsatisfactoriness. And then, how does that lead to understanding of not self? Well, oh yeah, that means this is impermanent too. This is just an impermanent arising, just like everything else. This is just part of that stream of things that are arising there for a while and then they're gone. That it has no solidity, no permanence, no sense of self embedded in it at all. But I don't see that until I understand impermanence and understand the nature of unsatisfactoriness. So it's sort of a progression of things we come through. Not self being the hard one or the hardest of the three. And the Buddha attests to that. As the Buddha was sitting under the Bodhi tree, he said the last thing that he had to overcome was a subtle sense of a permanent self. He had to really understand not self perfectly, clearly. His sense of a separate self was still there in subtle ways, but it was still there. And once he could let go of that, then he, enlightenment arose. So it might take us a while to work on this one. It's like, we don't have to rush into it tonight. We can think about it for sure, though. So, of course, I have a piece of poetry here just to. And this, I chose this particular poem because I think it's a wonderful expression of the life of a householder. This is from Mary Oliver's book, Why I Wake Early. And it's called November. The snow began slowly, a soft and easy sprinkling of flakes, then clouds of flakes in the baskets of the wind and the branches of the trees. Oh, so pretty. We walked through the growing stillness as the flakes prickled the path, then covered it, then deepened, as if curds and drifts, as the wind grew stronger, shaping its work less delicately, taking great steps over the hills and through the trees, until finally we were cold. And far from home, we turned and followed our long shadows back to the house, stamped our feet, went inside and shut the door. Through the window, we could see how far away it was to the gates of April. Let the fire now put on its red hat and sing to us. This is householder life described really sweetly. You're just going for a walk and then coming home and hanging out by the fire. Makes me single.